Welcome to a special edition of Museum Chat Live. Our community is filled with diverse stories, and we recognize that our story begins with the indigenous peoples of this land. We acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on lands that have been inhabited by indigenous peoples for millennia, and we would like to honor the centuries of indigenous peoples who walked on Turtle Island before us. Well, it's 2024. With years behind us since we wrapped up the virtual museum lecture series, we've been able to share about half of the lectures with our wider audiences. We are thrilled to bring the rest of our hit lecture series to the podcast so that more of you can enjoy these fascinating stories and join in on the historical adventures. Of course, you can always catch the original lecture over on our YouTube channel. If you enjoy the lectures, our podcasts, and our programs, why not consider making a donation to the museum? Your donations help us to continue to provide the high quality and enjoyable programming that you have come to expect from us. We really appreciate any donation you're able to make. Visit our website, stcatharinesmuseum.ca, or give us a call at 905-984-8880 to make a donation. Your donation makes a difference. On today's episode of VMLS Via Podcast, we're sharing the history of early Black residents in St. Catharines with a lecture titled The Daily Grind, The Records of Freedom Seekers in St. Catharines, presented by Abby Stansfield. This lecture was originally recorded on February 1st, 2022. Enjoy the lecture.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me this evening. As Adrian said, I started here at the museum in August, but I'm not new to museums in Niagara. I've been working in Niagara area museums since 2006. I started at the Laura Secord Homestead, and in 2015, I moved to the Port Colborne Historical Marine Museum as their education programmer, and this August, I joined the St. Catharines Museum team. I have my master's in museum studies, and my focus was on interpretation and its value in sharing history. So I have a great love and passion for researching and sharing local history. That's where I really tend to shine. So I was very excited to be able to prepare tonight's lecture. And I want to thank everybody for coming out and giving me the opportunity to give this lecture, The Daily Grind. Not long after I started here at the museum, I was offered the opportunity to give tonight's lecture and was both excited and cautious. Excited because domestic history is my historical passion, and I was just itching to dig into the primary resources and explore the daily life of St. Catharines residents. I was cautious because anyone who studied history extensively knows that primary resources for many sections of society are virtually non-existent. However, that part of me that likes to play historical detective took over, and I decided to commit to the daily life of freedom seekers. I want to start by saying that I am in no way the definitive authority on this topic any more than I am on any topic except for, well, this is according to me, heritage cooking, sheepdogs, and Harry Potter. Rather, my approach to historical research has always been to help others locate, navigate, and expand the understanding of a topic and hopefully inspire you to go further. Knowing my approach, my goal for tonight in respect to the daily grind is I want you to take away that inclusion in the civic and social record demonstrated a transition from refugee to citizen in St. Catharines' freedom seeker population. Broken down, what this really means is by using primary resources from the Underground Railroad era, I'm going to highlight what came after the last stop on the Underground Railroad. The excited historian in me wants to jump right in and tell you all about the people that I found and the evidence of their daily lives. Because that's what I really find exciting and what keeps me looking for more and more primary resources and reading secondary resources, so I can track down the primary ones. However, that's like dropping you in the middle of a story. To start at the beginning is to tell you where and how I found the information that we will be looking at tonight. Several primary sources exist from the Underground Railroad era that contain the words of freedom seekers, which is really exciting to actually hear or read rather the experiences of this population and community in their own words. What is more records mean having more records means we have a diverse cross-section of society to understand how different people from the same community felt about the same issue. The sources that I found for tonight's lecture include William Still's The Underground Railroad, Benjamin Drew's A North Side View of Slavery, the Freedmen Inquiries Committee's transcript interviews, and the Howe Report. And after using these sources to find the names and details of freedom seekers, I used the census of Canada West that was done in 1861 and 1871 and directories to see if these people stayed in the area, specifically in St. Catharines, after their testimonies. So to give us a start, I started my research with the Underground Railroad, which was written by William Still, who was pictured to the left there. Still was a Philadelphia clerk who was an extremely active abolitionist. In the 14 years that he worked as part of the Underground Railroad, he helped almost 800 freedom seekers find freedom, which is extraordinary. During this time, Still kept records of the freedom seekers that he helped, extensive records. If you take a look at the book, it's over 500 pages, I wanna say closer to 800. Depending on which version you're looking at. So one of the quotes that he gave was, "The heroism and desperate struggle that many of our people had to endure should be kept green in the memory of this and coming generations." So after the American Civil War, Still compiled this book, including his records, and he called it The Underground Railroad. This book is of interest to our purposes because it contained letters written by freedom seekers when they reached St. Catharines. They would send these letters to Still, designed to go through him to other destinations, including family that was still in the United States, or to Still himself to send their messages to other members of who helped them to freedom along the way on the Underground Railroad. Much of the subject matter in these letters is to let the members in Still Circle know that they have made it safely to Canada, or message to loved ones still in the United States. These letters give a good indication of the extreme relief and gratitude that freedom seekers have when they finally made it to Canada. The letter that struck me when I was studying the Underground Railroad was one written by Jacob Loxton. So this is Jacob Loxton on the 1861 census of Canada West, which I was really excited to find actual record of him. At this point, he has moved on from St. Catharines and he is in Stamford, which is now part of Niagara Falls. But not too far away. Still's background context for Jacob's letter, which we'll read in a minute, was that he arrived when he was only 27 years old and had been enslaved to a man in Sussex County, Delaware, whose only business was to drink whiskey and farm. The motivation for Jacob's escape was knowledge that he could be sold at any minute, much like livestock. He decided that he wasn't going to let that happen. And after planning for his wife and son to follow him, should he make it to Canada, he left. When Jacob Bloxam writes his wife from St. Catharines, he provides some amazing detail on the life that he has started here since his arrival. The letter starts, St. Catharines, Canada West, December 26, 1858. Dear wife, I now inform you that I am in Canada and I am well and hope you are the same. And wish you would be here next August. You come to the suspension bridge and from there to St. Catharines. Write and let me know. I am doing well working for a butcher this winter and will get some good wages in the spring. I now get $2.50 a week. I, Jacob Bloxam, George Lewis, and George Alligood, and James Alligood are all in St. Catharines. And met George Ross from Lewis Wright's. Jim Bloxam is in Canada West, and Jim Delaney, Plymouth Cannon. I expect you, my wife, Leah Ann Bloxam, my son, Alexander, and Lewis and Ames will all be here, and Isabella also. If you can't bring Alexander Shirley, write when you will come, and I will meet you in Albany. Love to you all from your loving husband, Jacob Bloxam. And then he added a postscript. Fare through here is $12.30. This letter really gives the reader a lot of good information about life in St. Catharines. We know that he spent the winter of 1859 working for a butcher and making what he saw as good wages at $2.50 a week. To give a rough comparison, $2.50 in the 1850s is worth about $89 today. That is a very rough estimate, mind you, based on inflation, but gives you an idea of the conversion. When you consider that Jacob details what it would cost to get to St. Catharines at $12.30 per person, which would be about $440 today, considering that he wanted to meet his family in Albany and bring them the rest of the way, we can only imagine that the cost would be multiplied by 3 at least. That would have been a lot of money to save, particularly since he would have had to include room and board deducted from his weekly wages. He mentions that he's expecting to make good wages in the spring. Presumably, this would have been more than the $2.50 that he was making at the butcher's. We find that in addition to his securing work, he takes the time to tell his wife about the others that are here, George Lewis, George Alligood, and James Alligood. Reading the background that still provides details that these men were traveling together as a group. Adding them to his letter makes sense because it provides confirmation that everybody arrived safely. I was also excited to when Jacob mentions George Ross, because George is a freedom seeker that provided his own testimony and that we will look at in a little bit. Going back to Jacob, I started to look for his evidence in St. Catharines documents and did not have much luck. I was really ready to give up and move on to other freedom seekers when I decided as a last ditch effort to widen my search and managed to find him here in Stamford on the census. How can I be sure that it's the Jacob Bloxam that we're looking for? I try not to get too excited because, for example, George Ross, who I mentioned, there were 2 living in St. Catharines at the same time. So it's very easy to get the wrong person when you're looking at these records. But I was able to confirm that this is the one we're looking for because he was living with George Lewis and George Alligood, who he mentions in his letters, who are the next 2 names below his, underneath the arrow there. I did find it slightly disappointing or sad, the fact that his wife and son are not living with him. And it looks like he's living in a boarding residence, just due to the people who are living in the household. He is listed as a laborer according to the census, as are both Georges. This started to pique my curiosity to see if I could find any further records of the life of Jacob for the ones he left behind. Still gives us in his testimony the name of his enslaver and where he is from. So I attempted to see if I could find this gentleman and thus see if I could find any record of Jacob's family close by. As you can imagine, this line of inquiry met with a brick wall. It was a long shot, I know. However, someday I would like to continue my search and see if there's any trace of Leah and Alexander. What we can assume, however, is that they were not able to come the following August as Jacob had planned, because 18 months after the letter was written, he's living in a boarding house without them. What happened to Jacob and George, Lewis and George Alligood, it's not entirely clear. It is possible that they returned to the United States after the Civil War, as many other freedom seekers who had been coming here did after the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850. He did not reappear in the census of 1871, at least in this region of Canada West. Granted, there's any number of things that could have happened in the span of 10 years. It's entirely possible that Jacob and his companions end up in another county or another province in Canada, or it makes sense they returned home to his family if they were not able to make it here. So my next source was the refugee, and it provides more detail on the daily lives of freedom seekers. It was written by Benjamin Drew, and the North Side View of Slavery, or the Refugee, it's known as. Drew was an abolitionist who traveled throughout Canada West documenting the testimonies of freedom seekers in their own words. Regarding St. Catharines, he had this to say: refugee, refugee for the oppressed, refuge for the Americans escaping from the abuse and cruel bondage in their native land, refuge from my countrymen, from the lash of the overseer, from the hounds and guns of the southern manhunters, from the clutches of the northern marshals and commissioners. Rest, rest for the hunted slave, rest for the travel-soiled and the foot-sore fugitive. Refuge and rest. These are the first ideas which arise in my mind in connection with the town of St. Catharines. I might well mention here, it's a pleasant situation. Its commercial advantages, the Welland Canal near Niagara Falls, its telegraphic wires, its railroads, its famous mineral springs, and other matters interesting to the tourists. But we will step aside from these and look at St. Catharines as the peaceful home of hundreds of the colored race. Drew, in his introduction to the settlement, is providing the reader with glimpses into what St. Catharines has to offer. This statement has a very favorable view of St. Catharines as a peaceful community for freedom seekers with many modern amenities. Many of the tourist features of St. Catharines that Drew mentions are industries that were providing jobs for freedom seekers. The interviews from this work provide testimonies of 23 freedom seekers that have settled here in St. Catharines. One of these was William Gross, and this is his mention in the 1861 census of Canada West. He is still in Lincoln County in the town of St. Catharines. William begins his testimony by detailing his escape from Harper's Ferry, Virginia. At the age of 25, he faced the probability that he would be sold because he was married to a freed woman. And they feared that he would get it in his head to escape based on this fact. Originally, he had intended to escape to the north of his own country and stay there. When he decided that he could not live safely in the United States because of the fears of being captured, he found a friend that helped him relocate to Canada. At the point that he's being interviewed, he has been in Canada for 5 years after having been a slave for 25 years. I have the rights and privileges of any other man, he's quoted as saying. I am now living with my wife and children and doing very well. When I lie down at night, I don't feel afraid of oversleeping so that my employer might jump on me if he pleased. I'm a true British subject, and I have a boat every year as much as any other man. I often used to wonder in the United States when I saw carriages going around for voters, why they never asked me to vote. But I have since found out the reason. I know now that they were using my vote instead of my using it. Now I use it for myself. Now I feel like a man, and I'm not a man, and I wish to God that all my fellow creatures could feel the same freedom that I feel. I am not prejudiced against the white race in the United States. It is only the portion that sustain the cursed laws of slavery. There's plenty of land here and schools to educate your children. I have no education myself, but I don't intend to let my children come up as I did. I have but two, and instead of making servants out of them, I will give them a good education, which I could not do in the southern portion of the United States. True, they were not born slaves there, but I could not have given them an education. I have been through both Upper and Lower Canada and have found that the colored people keeping stores, farming, etc., and doing well. I have made more money since I came here than I made in the United States. I know several colored people who have become wealthy by industry, owning horses and carriages. One of them, who was a fellow servant of mine, now owns two span of horses and two as fine carriages as there are on the bank. And as a general thing, the colored people are more sober and industrious than in the States. They feel when they have money that they cannot make what use they would like of it. They are kept so down, so looked upon. Here they have something to do with their money and put it to good purpose. I am employed at the Clifton House on the Falls. Rose provides a look at what it's like to be a true British citizen, as he's quoted as saying. After having started life in Canada as a refugee, he highlights that he has the right to vote the same as any other man, and how different that feels from having his vote decided for him. It is the rights that he has gained by being in Canada that make it so he can look any white man in the eye, as he says elsewhere in the testimony. Rose also provides us with a very open look at things in society that make him feel like a citizen in his new home. The first is that he can sleep at night without fear that somebody can legally come into his home and harm him. That there is land in Canada to make a home on gives us an account of the material success he has seen achieved by Black business persons in Canada. That they own their own horses and carriages states that their wealth and accomplishments. Today, it would be like owning an expensive car that you had to house and feed. To keep horses for a carriage was a status symbol. Rose provides that he lives with his wife and children, which wasn't a conclusion that was granted to guaranteed to freedom seekers, as we saw in Jacob's story. That he was able to bring his family with him is possibly what contributed to the life he was able to build here. With the incentive to provide his children with an education to elevate their station in life, Rose would have been looking to stay in one area long enough to become part of that community. He also provides us with the information that he's employed in the hospitality sector at the Clifton House, and we can assume that his aspirations for his children were a profession outside of labor and hospitality sectors. Freedom seeker highlight that jumped out at me when I was reading them was Reverend Alexander Hemsley. And this is another freedom seeker that testimony that Drew accounts that is a contrast to Brose's. It is the testimony of Alexander Hemsley. Drew has this foreword, which is up on your screen now, to the testimony, which he didn't really do in any of the other ones, which is why this one jumped out at me, that speaks to the conditions that he found the Reverend in when he came to interview him. He states that while the Reverend Hemsley is in poor health and confined to his bed with dropsy, which we would know as an edema buildup of fluid in the limbs today. He is cared for by his wife, but despite his ailment, is in good cheer. He has lost two children to the ailment, since they moved to St. Catharines, which is alluded to later in his testimony. His home is described as clean and nice and could be mortgage-free for $200. The impact that the Reverend Hemsley must have made on Drew is that Drew is so impactful that Drew is looking for a benefactor to buy out the mortgage for his home and garden, and speaks volumes to the character that he found while he was interviewing. Hemsley explains that he escaped slavery not once, but twice. He was someone who managed to make a decent living for himself when he fled slavery the first time to New Jersey. He worked hard in his new home and was able to create a comfortable life there. However, the laws weren't in his favor, and he ended up having to flee after he was recaptured. The second time, he fled to Canada and originally ended up in Toronto. He's quoted in Drew's book as saying, "When I reached English territory, I had a comfort in the law, that my shackles were struck off and that a man was a man by law. I had been in comfortable circumstances, but all my little property was lawed away. I was among strangers, poverty-stricken, and in a cold country. I had been used to farming and so could not find in the city such assistance as I needed. In a few days, I left for St. Catharines, where I have ever since remained. When I reached St. Catharines, I was enfeebled in health. I had come to a small, inferior place. There were pines growing all about here where you now see brick houses. I rented a house and with another man took 5 acres of land, cleared land, and got along with it very well. We did not get enough from this to support us, but I got work at half a dollar or 75 cents a day and board myself. We were then making both ends meet. I then made up to my mind that salted potatoes in Canada were better than pound cake and chickens in a state of suspense and anxiety in New York, in United States. Now I am a regular Britisher. My American blood has been scourged out of me. I have lost my American tastes. I am an enemy to tyranny. I would as like meet serpents as some people I know of in these states. If I were to meet them, my fighting propensities would come up. To meet one here, I would not mind it. There, I would be afraid of the ghost of the white man after he was dead. I have served the people in the provinces as a minister in the Methodist persuasion for some 20 years. My pay has been little, for our people are all start poor and have to struggle to support themselves." Reverend Hemsley's testimony is interesting, as you can see the shift in his opinions in his life in Canada. He spent most of the earlier years in the country wishing and watching current events in the United States to see if there was any time in which he could safely return by his own admission. Things we know, however, got worse in the United States, not better, with the passing of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, and Hemsley continued to carve out a humble existence in Canada. We see his thinking shift when he says, "The better and simple life here in Canada of potatoes and salt was better than luxuries in the United States and worrying about your freedoms." Once this mindset sets in, it's almost like that was the exact moment that he became a citizen here in British North America and shed the pursuit of fine things, remnants of his life that he had built in New Jersey that had been taken from him. He took up the service of the community as a preacher and accepted that riches weren't his pursuit any longer. He does allude to the fact that illness since they have been in St. Catharines is the reason that they have yet to pay off the mortgage, that they had to, the money had to be spent to deal with illness. This point leads to a good follow-up on what was available to freedom seekers who were poor but required healthcare or couldn't work as a result of their illness. In the Freedmen Inquiry Commission's interview with John Kinney, Kinney details the existence of three societies here in St. Catharines that existed to aid the community of freedom seekers now that they live here in St. Catharines. Kinney tells us there's a women's society who generate the necessary funds to aid those who need funds for medical care or funds for being buried. He details that the Masons are happy to take care of the Masons and that there is a community society where membership puts in the funds that they can at every meeting. And this money is used to cover the costs of living when there is a case of illness in the community. If this type of aid is possible, then why didn't Reverend Hemsley take advantage of it? It is very possible that he did, and even with this aid, much of the money that he made still went to paying off doctor's bills for the illnesses that he and his children experienced. It is also possible that he saw the funds mentioned as being for those persons who were brand new to St. Catharines and needed them more than he did. I tend to favor this view as he mentions in his he mentions that he is a pastor and doesn't earn much money because the refugees who come here are poor to start with and need some time to find their place in society before they are more secure. The next source I used was the report to the Freedmen's Inquiry Commission, or as we know it, the Howe Report, and the interview transcripts. These were some of the first resources that I came in contact with when I started researching for this, and they weren't resources I had been familiar with prior to starting here at the museum. One thing that really helped me wrap my head around it all was last February's virtual museum lecture. If you haven't seen it yet, the one on the Howe Report, it is available on the playlist. You should definitely check it out. The background of this work I later discovered the reason that this report was written was to determine how the 20,000, that's the figure they give, freedom seekers who escaped to Canada are now faring. The observations are all taken by one man, Samuel Howe, and his journey across Canada's West to speak to the freedom seekers and find out firsthand their stories and how their life has changed. His argument to those in the United States that felt that freed slaves couldn't take care of themselves, as well as those who escaped to freedom in Canada, because he felt those who had already escaped, they felt that those who had already escaped were of a different kind of freedom seeker, that they were superior because they had managed to elude capture and returning to slavery. So there, he's quoted as saying, the refugees in Canada earn a living and gather property. They marry and respect women. They build churches and send their children to schools. They improve in manners and morals, not because they are picked men, but simply because they are freed men. These interviews, like Drew's work, gave the population of Canada West, and more specifically for our purposes, the refugee community in St. Catharines, an opportunity to tell their story in their own words. Both works touch on the hardships of slavery and the bravery that existed in terms of escaping. What I had not known was the extent of the prejudice that existed here in terms of their new lives in Canada. What comes out of these interviews is their perseverance that they exhibited and their ability to build a new life and community despite the barriers. So we get to meet George Ross in these interviews. And this is George Ross on the 1861 census. He's also listed on the 1871 census. So he was definitely remained in the community. One of the transcripts that stuck out to me was George Ross's when I was researching this topic. And it stood out to me because he's one of the freedom seekers whose name kept appearing over several different primary resources. Ross features most prominently in the transcript of his interview for the Freedmen Inquiry Commission. His testimony provides an insight into what his life has been like since he moved here around 1850. He chronicles that his early years in St. Catharines were difficult when he worked on a farm, but after doing 3 years of that, he moved on to being a driver or a waiter. At the time of his testimony, he was head waiter at the Stevenson Hotel. George also provides information on things we don't normally consider when thinking about the Underground Railroad or a refugee becoming acclimatized to our weather. Prior to studying these sources, I hadn't really considered what a large factor the weather can play in a decision about where to go on vacation, never mind where to move to. As people that would have predominantly lived in a warm climate, the shock of winter here, no matter how mild of one, would have been quite the strain. George gives an account on how he acclimatized to the weather since arriving to Canada. Prior to moving here, the rumor had been that only people raised in Canada could brave to live here because it was so cold. Instead, he logically deduced that what he would have to do to survive here was to dress himself in warm clothing to compensate for the cold. He reports to using that logic by saying that I have always got on well as I could in Hagerstown, Maryland, where he was from. George reveals that he has never been able to read himself, but that his children read and write very well. He says he has never found it difficult to find a job, even though he can't read and write, and it's because he believes in hard work. This theme of working hard to ensure that their children could have advantages that they didn't is a common theme among freedom seekers in the sources used today. I mentioned earlier that George is in multiple sources, including the one we discussed earlier. In case you don't remember, it was Jacob Bloxon, published in William Still's work, The Underground Railroad. Bloxon mentions the letter that he has met George Ross here in St. Catharines. We will never know for sure, but I don't believe that the two had known each other prior to Bloxon's arrival to Canada. Rather, I think that they met here, which would imply that George was involved in the, George was highly involved in the community. George and his oldest son are listed on an 1865 St. Catharines directory. The directory tells us that George has moved on from his position at the Stevenson Hotel as the head waiter and now works as a waiter at Houston's Saloon. George's son, Daniel Ross, is listed as a sailor, and he lived in the same house as his father, well, not out on the ships. Well, directories provide a wonderful glimpse at the heads of the house in St. Catharines. It does not tell us if there was any other Rosses who were residing at the house on North Street. The 1871 census, however, did mention that living in the Ross house at the time of the census was George, who was head of house and 57 years old, along with his wife Amelia, who was 48. She's also listed on the 1861 census right below George, underneath the blue arrow there. Both are listed as having been born in the United States. Also listed in the same household are Thomas, Ruth, and a William Bell, as well as a George L, who was one at the time of the 1871 census, and most likely George's senior's grandson. This also implies that Daniel the sailor had moved out by that point. And he's also not listed in the 1861 census, which may imply that he was off at work when they were conducting the census and wasn't at home at that point. Other sources also didn't name the females in the Ross family, so it's or any females of the gentleman we talked today living in the household. So it's really interesting to be able to put names to the spouses and children of these freedom seekers. There are testimony by female freedom seekers, I should mention, but rarely do we get to find out who the rest of the family is in a gentleman's testimony. So after George Ross, I decided to put one of those females' perspective and testimonies. And one testimony from the Freedmen's Inquiry Commission that provides a female perspective of the life in St. Catharines is Mrs. Brown. And I wasn't able to find her in a census, local census at least, which doesn't surprise me because in her testimony, she doesn't appear to want to stay in St. Catharines long-term. But she's quoted as saying, a good many of the colored people own their own houses and have owned them ever since I came here. When they came here, of course, they were destitute and had nothing. Most of them came from the slave states. There are some here who are doing very well. The colored people are capable of doing anything that they have a chance to do. All we want is good schools for the children and capital enough to give them a good trade. Like other freedom seekers, Mrs. Brown's concern appears to be for the education of the children in the community, and more specifically in her case, her grandson's education. She feels that she doesn't need to socialize with the rest of the community members, as she doesn't believe they will stay in St. Catharines long-term. Having been a free woman in New York State, they are living in Canada particularly to prevent anything from happening to her husband, who is from Maryland. Both she and her husband confess that they don't care for Canada and intend to return to the United States as soon as they are able, even after 15 and 22 years here, respectively. What this testimony provides us with is the knowledge that due to their dislike of the country, they probably didn't get as involved to the community as the other freedom seekers that we spoke of today because they weren't hoping to stay here long term. Instead, they continued to go from place to place, the next proposed place being Montreal, looking for something similar to what they had left behind. The only thing that Mrs. Brown professes that keeps them in Canada is that they are free under the law. A limitation to finding Mrs. Brown in other written records is that she doesn't provide her first name or her husband's name. Without knowing first names, it's hard to locate the pair in other records, in addition to the fact that they probably didn't stay here long enough that 3 years later they would have been counted on the census, or that they didn't buy land here. So after looking at several firsthand accounts of freedom seekers, what does their daily life really look like? Now that we have examined the sources, this is something that my colleague Sarah and I asked ourselves when we were designing the museum's new school on the Liberty Line school program. In the program, we introduced George Ross. That's probably another reason I took to him and followed him around town for a day in his life in 1863. One of the destinations that we follow Ross to on that day is to look for jobs for other freedom seekers. After reading the primary resources, one thing is for certain that the days were long and filled with work, particularly if you were an immigrant. The census data and testimonies detail working on farms in the hospitality industry as laborers, gardeners, in shops, and as servants, as well as a few that were in trade. We saw in Reverend Hemsley's testimony that farming didn't necessarily pay the bills. And sometimes there was outside work to be done in addition to help pay for everything. William Wells Brown, a former slave and predominant abolitionist writer, indicates that owning a home was a big part of the freedom seeker desires and wishes here in St. Catharines. And he provided this description of the settlement here known as Colortown. The Colored Settlement is a hamlet situated on the outskirts of the village and contains about 100 houses, 40 of which lie on North Street, the Broadway of the place. The houses are chiefly cottages with 3 to 6 rooms and on lots of land, nearly a quarter of an acre each. Each family has a good garden, well filled with vegetables, ducks, chickens, and a pig pen, with at least one fat renter getting ready for Christmas. The houses with the lots upon which they stand are worth, upon average, about $500 each. The houses in the settlement are all owned by their occupants. And from inquiry, I learned that people were generally free from debt. Out of the 800 in St. Catharines, about 700 of them are fugitive slaves. Among them, I found 17 carpenters, 4 blacksmiths, 6 coopers, and 5 shoemakers. 2 omnibuses and 2 hacks are driven by colored men. So from this quote, we're led to believe that owning a home also meant that taxes would have been paid and that these freedom seekers were contributing members to the growth of St. Catharines and their own community. So through Jacob Glockson's letter, we learned that he was making about $2.50 a week in wages working for a butcher. This figure gives us a good context of how well freedom seekers were paid in comparison to the price of commodities. So the picture on the right is of the St. Catharines market. While the picture on the left gives you the prices at the market on a day in 1863, in August of 1863. By looking at the price list, you understand why those gardens that they tended at home were important, as you could easily spend your take-home pay on filling the larder alone. And not included are things like maple syrup and coffee and tea, which were, I think, tea started at 75 cents a pound, which is a lot of tea, but it would already be taking a large chunk of your weekly wages if you were foolish enough to spend it on that. What were the other components that made up the daily lives of freedom seekers? Well, work and caring for their homes was a big part of their daily lives. The records indicate that involving themselves in the community was also a big part of their life in regards to their social lives. The community came together to build the BME Church, Salem Chapel, which is the picture on the screen there, and the Zion Baptist Church. But they weren't just places of worship. These spaces were the earliest gathering places for the Black community. The congregation actively supported newly arrived freedom seekers in finding houses, employment, and building community connections. The church was also a major part of the social life for their congregations, organizing picnics, pageants, and other gatherings. It was experience that bonded these individuals and led them to form such a tight-knit community to raise their families in. And if you want to examine that kind of experience more, be sure to join Sarah for the On the Liberty Line virtual tours later this month. She does a very good job at that. So the profiles that we looked at today have given us all glimpses into the lives of St. Catharines freedom seekers after they had finished their journeys and arrived in Canada. Life was not easy, as we saw, even to those who have become successful in the United States, they basically had to start over here at the beginning. Many found themselves starting their lives in this country very poor and had to spend the first years of their lives here just making things work until they became settled enough. Additional records contained in the sources that I mentioned tonight tell the stories of newcomers. In these narratives, the focus is often on the lives that they have just left behind, and the journey getting here. It is understandable that after fleeing and trusting your life to complete strangers who you have never met, that the focus would be around this event that you had just experienced. Other central focuses of the newcomers in these sources are on getting messages to those they have had to leave behind, getting clothing forwarded to them as they arrived with literally what they were wearing, and ensuring that they haven't lost everything when they were forced to flee, and to thank people that helped them along the way and let them know that they are safe. The census data from this period also contains the names of other families that were part of this community. The census contains names, marriage statuses, country of origin, ethnicity, age, and what type of house they lived in, occupation, and religion, which is a lot of information to know about somebody, a lot of great information. One benefit of the community living so close together was that when the census is collected, it's done geographically, which means there are pages of freedom seekers all bundled together. With more examination of these records, even more will come to light about the lives of freedom seekers who lived in St. Catharines. The testimonies that we have examined today, however, tells the stories of those who have been in Canada for at least a short while, if not years, before we hear their stories. In these cases, they have been here long enough that their experiences in St. Catharines are becoming important to their story. That is where we begin to see the transformation from new arrival or refugee to becoming members of the community. The more engaged they become when they are in St. Catharines and in the community, the more pride that they took in the community. Often when visitors came to St. Catharines, the most part of the abolition movement, they comment on the community that has been built there. There is always favorable outlook of the nice homes that the freedom seekers own, mentions to their industry, hard work to purchase their homes and make a living. The community is an example of what freedom and independence look like to them. Many freedom seekers living in St. Catharines mentioned that work here was hard. Often work here is just as hard as the lives they led while they were enslaved, and in a few cases harder. Yet they continue to do the work, initially seeing it as the payoff for their freedom. Finally, they can look white people in the eye and feel on equal footing. This freedom is well cited as an incentive to keep going despite the difficulties that they met with. However, the longer they stay and the more integrated they became in the community, they begin to share a dream and similar goals, like things like the education of their children as being the most vital goal. When schooling for Black children in St. Catharines wasn't working, a member of the community, Elder Perry, opened up a school and made sure to collect the fees on a weekly basis because the pupils' parents were poor and that's how they could afford to send their children to get a better education. The journey to Canada on the Underground Railroad was long, hard, and full of fear. Life in Canada, particularly in the beginning, was long and hard, yet full of promise because of their freedom. Ensuring that others could experience freedom and what it meant is what brought them together as a community to provide aid societies, build worship houses, and build their homes together within St. Catharines. Providing a better life for their children is what drove them to ensure that schooling was a priority and it was not provided prompted community members to provide their skills in opening a school. With industriousness and determination, the refugee populations of St. Catharines built a life and turned themselves into citizens of this freedom seeker community, which enriched the St. Catharines of the Underground Railroad era and provided a legacy of enrichment in future generations of African Canadians who have called St. Catharines home.
Hi, it's Adrian again. We really hope you enjoyed the lecture. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us via our social media channels or at museum@stcatharines.ca. If you enjoy the lectures, our podcasts, and our programs, why not consider making a donation to the museum? Your donations help us to continue to provide the high quality and enjoyable programming that you have come to expect from us. We really appreciate any donation you're able to make. Visit our website, stcatharinesmuseum.ca, or give us a call at 905-984-8880 to make a donation. Your donation makes a difference. Don't forget to subscribe to our social media channels, blog, and podcasts, so you don't miss any of the historical fun. More information is available on our website, stcatharinesmuseum.ca. Next time on VMLS via podcast, from Anatevka to St. Catharines, the early years of the spiritual home of the Jewish community. Thanks for listening. The Virtual Museum Lecture Series is presented by the St. Catharines Museum and Welland Canal Center.